This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Blueprint for Wealth, a program dedicated to securing your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. Now, here's your host, Wayne Zell.
Good morning and welcome to Blueprint for Wealth. I'm Wayne Zell, your host of this fast-paced half hour of special topics and special guests designed to help you realize your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. The show, Blueprint for Wealth, is brought to you by Odin Feldman and Pittleman, a full-service law firm located in Reston, Virginia, serving the entire Washington, D.C. metro area with clients all across the country. If you'd like to know more about us, visit us on the web at ofplaw.com or call us to make an appointment at 703-218-2100. Also, I invite you to subscribe to my blog, blueprintforwealth.org, which is available on the web. And there you can get content on tax, estate planning, and business planning topics of interest, as well as videos, audios, and articles. And lastly, I invite you to read my column in the Washington Business Journal once a month entitled Blueprint for Wealth, where we explore topics of interest in tax, estate planning, and business planning. Now, today there's a lot of discussion about the fiscal cliff. We're about ready to fall off the fiscal cliff, or Congress and the president will reach a compromise before the end of the year in a lame duck session. Today, I want to focus on one of the alternatives that's being proposed to resolve the dilemma of the fiscal cliff, and that is one that was proposed over 2 years ago by the National Commission on Fiscal Responsibility and Reform, also known as the Bowles-Simpson Commission. The stars of that commission, of course, were former Senator Alan Simpson and former White House advisor Erskine Bowles. It was a presidential commission that was created in 2010 by President Obama to identify policies to improve the fiscal situation in the medium term and to achieve fiscal sustainability over the long term. The commission first met in April of 2010 and released a report on December the 1st of 2010. But it failed a vote on December the 3rd with 11 out of 18 possible votes in favor of the commission's report and a supermajority required of 14. So it didn't pass the commission, so therefore it never made it to the congressional floors, to the House or the Senate, or for consideration by the president. The original proposal for a commission came out of bipartisan legislation. Bipartisan, that's a hard word to actually stomach these days, but it would be something that we would love to see happen this year. And it was bipartisan legislation that would have required Congress to vote on its recommendations as presented without any amendment. And that was back in January 2010. That bill failed the Senate by a vote of 53-46, where six Republicans who had co-sponsored it joined with 23 Democratic senators in the Senate at large and voted against it. The Republican opponents of the idea, including the defecting co-sponsors, said they objected to delegating congressional control over fiscal decisions. The commission's authority to recommend revenue-raising ideas such as tax increases, and a perception that the commission wasn't focused enough on spending cuts. Now, we're looking back in history, only 2 years, to the commission as being a potential panacea for the fiscal cliff. Now, let me explore what the commission report proposed back in 2010. Now, and before I do, let me just identify who the members of the commission were. I mentioned Alan Simpson. He was co-chair, former U.S. Senator. There was Erskine Bowles, former White House chief of staff. And then there were various others, including Representative Paul Ryan, who was the vice presidential Republican candidate from Wisconsin, and a few others, including Dave Camp from Michigan. And then on the Senate side, Senator Judd Gregg, Tom Coburn, and Mike Crapo from Idaho. And then on the Democratic side, we had Representative John Spratt, Xavier Becerra, Jan Schakowsky, and then Senators Richard Durbin, Max Baucus, and Kent Conrad. And so it was a fairly esteemed group of congressional participants, as well as others from industry who participated. We had the head of Honeywell International, David Cote, and we had Andy Stern, former president of Service Employees International Union, Alice Rivlin, who was with the Brookings Institution but was former director of the Congressional Budget Office, and various others participating on this commission. The idea of a commission reaching a proposal that was bipartisan was extremely important. And what they came up with was a basic five-point plan. Number one was a $200 billion deficit reduction package that included discretionary spending cuts, with proposed cuts including reducing defense procurement by 15% and closing one-third of the overseas military bases. And the proposal also included a eliminating earmarks, the so-called specific benefits that go to the various jurisdictions around the country, eliminating earmarks and cutting the federal workforce by 10%. This was $200 billion per year for 10 years that they were proposing. Next, number two, was $100 billion in annual increased tax revenues through various tax reform proposals. They proposed including a 15-cent per gallon gas tax, and eliminating or restricting a variety of tax deductions, including the home mortgage interest deduction, and the deduction that corporations and other businesses enjoy for employer-provided health care benefits. Number three, the commission recommended controlling health care costs by maintaining the Medicare cost controls that were included in the recent Obama health care legislation. In addition, they proposed considering a public option and a further increase in the authority of independent payment advisory boards. Number four, there was a suggested reduction in entitlements, including farm subsidies, civilian and military federal pensions, and student loan subsidies. And lastly, and most importantly, there were suggested modifications to the Social Security program that would raise the payroll tax and also increase the retirement age. After the chairman's briefing to the commission members, two Democratic Party members, Senator Durbin and Representative Schakowsky, publicly criticized the plan. Senator Conrad, who was a Democrat from North Dakota, declined to criticize the proposal. Instead, he said, instead of shooting down the proposal, propose an alternative. I think that's where we are today with the commission's report. The proposal was dismissed as unserious by Paul Krugman for its large proposed cuts in income tax rates. Krugman dismissed the idea that current marginal rates are a drag on economic growth and suggests that economic growth can still be sustained in light of increasing tax rates. The proposal was better received by the Democrat-affiliated but business-friendly think tank Third Way. Representative Jim Cooper, a Democrat from Tennessee, and Senator Ron Wyden, a Democrat from Oregon, also supported the proposals. President Obama asked critics of the proposal from both sides of the political spectrum to exercise caution and said, before anybody starts shooting down the proposals, I think we need to listen. We need to gather up all the facts. A report was released, again, on December the 1st, 2010, but failed to pass because it required a 14-vote supermajority. Voting for the report were Democrat Bowles, Coburn, Conrad, Crapo, Cote, Durbin, Fudge, Gregg, Rivlin, Simpson, former Republican senator, and Spratt. Voting against it were Senator Baucus, Becerra, Camp, Hensarling, Paul Ryan, Schakowsky, and Stern. The commission has been criticized as deliberating in secret and as being stacked with people who want to target entitlement spending rather than any balanced proposal, because it could lead to benefits for Social Security and Medicare, cuts in benefits for Social Security and Medicare. Many Democrats are calling this the so-called cat food commission. They don't want to cut Social Security or Medicare, and they want to retain benefits at their current levels. They're more inclined to increase taxes. On the other hand, the Republicans have been increasingly proposing cuts in Medicare and Social Security. I think the logical result should be that everybody consider a little bit of both. Everybody's got to bear the pain, which is seems to be the consensus that's arising in the discussions that are leading up to a resolution of the fiscal cliff problem. This whole commission issue continued into 2011. In fact, in November of 2011, Simpson and Bowles submitted written testimony to the so-called super committee that is charged with making budget adjustments by Congress. They urged the 12 members of the super committee to go big toward a $4 trillion savings cut that was recommended by the commission, versus the $1.2 trillion deficit reduction that will be achieved through sequestration. Now, Simpson and Bowles are concerned and warned that failure to reach some agreement might result in another downgrade in our debt ratings, our securities ratings. But Moody's has separately said that such a failure alone wouldn't result in further change in U.S. ratings because the trigger of sequestration will still result in automatic $1.2 trillion in spending cuts. I guess time will tell whether or not Congress or the president can reach a consensus that will avoid us from falling over the fiscal cliff. Let's keep our ears and eyes open and hope that they can reach some kind of logical consensus before the end of the year. If you'd like to know more about some of the tax provisions or other spending cut provisions in the commission's proposals, I'd be happy to talk to you about it. Give us a call at 703-218-2100 or visit us on the web if you'd like to know more about the services offered by Odin Feldman and Pittleman at ofplaw.com.
You're listening to Blueprint for Wealth with Wayne Zell. Learn how to better prepare for your future when Blueprint for Wealth returns in a moment.
A Legal Minute with Wayne Zell.
Who is considered an independent contractor? Many employers use independent contractors to carry out essential aspects of their business. Many independent contractors enjoy the freedom of self-employment as they perform freelance work for various companies. But who is considered an independent contractor, and what are the implications of being so considered? The term independent contractor has its primary implications in the tax area. An independent contractor works for a business and performs distinct tasks for the employer. The IC could be a writer in a marketing company who writes for certain projects as the need arises. An IC is generally not guaranteed work, but may be tapped for jobs on an as-needed basis. The IRS's rule for determining who is an independent contractor is that the employer has control over the end result. But the independent contractor has control over how the work is going to be performed. In all cases, the IRS has the final say on whether a worker is an independent contractor.
Welcome back to Blueprint for Wealth, a program dedicated to securing your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. If you have questions for Wayne, you can email him at radio@ofplaw.com or call him at 703-218-2100. Now back to your host, Wayne Zell.
Welcome back to Blueprint for Wealth. I'm Wayne Zell, and with me today is my special guest, Brent Lorenz, a vice president at McLean Group's headquarters office. Is it Lorenz or Lawrence?
Either way, Lorenz is fine.
Just want to make sure I get it right. Thanks for being a special guest today. Brent provides merger and acquisition advisory services to middle market software and engineering services firms. He's an you're an engineer, right?
I'm an electrical engineer by training.
Holy moly! You know, I'm intimidated
across the table.
In particular, he focuses on working with companies in markets such as cybersecurity, embedded software and semiconductors, and GUI, graphical user interface.
That's right. right.
Data visualization is another area that he works in, imaging, networking infrastructure software. And he's a member of the McLean Group's technology and telecommunications in aerospace, defense, and government M&A practices. Prior to joining McLean Group, Brent spent about 15 years working in the tech industry, including companies such as Texas Instruments, IBM Software Group, and a venture capital startup or two. And he's had a long history of working with embedded software firms, including Wind River. I have a client that probably worked with you. And Telogy Networks and Trinity Convergence. So without further ado, Brent, you've got a really interesting background. And it's very different from what I see with typical investment bankers who are finance geeks or, you know, MBAs out of this, that, or the other. How did you get into investment banking?
Yeah, thanks. I mean, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure. I would have to admit I probably do have about the most roundabout path for getting into investment banking. You know, the short answer is I went from being a sales engineer to a semiconductor product manager and a retail franchise entrepreneur to investment banker. Uh-huh. And originally, I studied electrical engineering, and I was hired by Texas Instruments to join their technical sales training program. And they like to hire, you know, guys with engineering degrees, guys and gals, and send them out to do technical sales to talk to engineers. And my primary career was technology sales, business development, and product management for about 15 years, as you mentioned. And I was at big companies like TI and IBM. I was also at some small companies that were venture capital funded. It was also during this time that I, at the University of Maryland, I earned an MBA, and I started thinking a lot about entrepreneurship and small business, and that it would be fun to either be, you know, an entrepreneur or work with entrepreneurs. It just sounded pretty exciting. So one of the steps that I took is I decided to dip my toes in the water of entrepreneurship and actually own a business. And so I bought a retail franchise, which was a general nutrition center franchise that was
hold on a
local.
Second. You bought a retail franchise?
I did. I bought a GNC franchise too.
Why? You're an engineer.
Yeah.
What do you know about nutrition?
You know, I was an athlete. I actually had a college scholarship to a junior college for a year. And so I've always been interested in health and sports and nutrition. It's sort of a little side hobby of mine. And actually, I bought a business that I shopped at, and I just thought it was exciting and interesting. And I wanted to dip my toe in the water without quitting my day job, and so this was a perfect way to do that. And
how did it go?
Yeah, it went well. I mean, I didn't hit a home run, but it's kind of hard to hit a home run with one small
one store.
You either got to buy a bunch of them, you know, you have to scale it up.
You were a franchisee?
I was a franchisee.
Right.
Yeah, so it's kind of entrepreneurship light is the way I'd explain
it. That's a good way to cut your teeth in the business like that. So so you did that, and then from franchising, where did you go from there?
Well, it was right around this time I started thinking about doing M&A work, and that it'd be a lot of fun. You know, it had been kind of in the back of my mind that it'd be something I'd like to pursue. It just took me a while to bite the bullet. And part of the reason why I chose franchising to start with, because I was never the creative guy that was going to take an idea and start a business from scratch. And I have so much credit or respect for folks that do that.
Right.
But I'm more of a sales and finance and execution kind of guy. So this was a good way to get started. And, you know, there's an old saying that the two best days of your life are the day you bought your boat and sold your boat. And it's an old joke I tell too many times, but for me, those days were the day I bought my business and sold my business. And so it was just a lot more fun to put on a name tag or to buy it and sell it than it was to put on a name tag and actually, you know, run it every day.
Yeah, that's tough. Retailing, I grew up in retailing, and it's a hard business to be in. So unless you really want to spend the long hours and cultivate the customer relationships and do it day after day after day, year after year, it can be a long grind. It can be very difficult.
And if you want it to be your primary career, you need to go for something, you know, swing for the fences and go for something big enough that you could actually make a living at, or that you can scale upwards and buy 10 of them or something like that.
Well, you worked for Texas Instruments, you worked for IBM. Those are big companies, and they're great companies.
Right.
They have great, you know, training. What are some of the biggest advantages and lessons that you learned, and how do you apply them today at McLean Group?
Right. Well, I mean, the answers, the reasons why there are good places to be are things that you'd kind of expect. I mean, they're big, stable companies, and primarily if you're a sales engineer or doing business development, they have products that people want, and so you get a lot of doors open, you get to talk to a lot of people because of the reputation of the company. And so it's great experience to get your feet wet and, you know, business and the right way to do things, and so it was good experience for that for that regard.
So, and the training, I imagine, is pretty good there, too.
Very good. Yeah, you know, there's an old saying that, you know, when TI hires you out of college, they send you down to Texas to lobotomize you and send you off into the world. But it's true. I mean, that you go down for the training program, you spend a year to 2 years and just learning about technology and how to sell. And it's great for people with engineering backgrounds coming out of college. So it was a great start.
So how would you compare your experience in a big giant company like IBM or TI and a venture capital startup,
right,
which I've worked with many over my career, and I understand how interesting that can be as well.
Right. Well, it's very different. I mean, it's a much different risk-reward ratio. You never know if the company is going to hit it big or go out of business the next week. You know, working in those startups, you can get a lot of broader responsibility much more quickly. You have to be much more creative about how to get things done. And that's the kind of environment that you want to be able to thrive in if you're going to be happy there. It's not about the money or the potential trade-off. It's that you enjoy doing that. And sometimes you just have to make decisions and beg for forgiveness later.
What did you do at the venture capital startups?
I did business development and technical sales at both of them.
Because you're an engineer, you understand the products,
right,
that they were developing. Was it you mentioned it was voice over IP and
that's
those,
right,
types of products?
Yeah, both of them were voice over IP related. One was, mm-hmm, more on the enterprise level, which was managing Cisco IP telephony gear. And then the other side was more embedded, meaning that it was, you know, baked into the chipset,
sure,
of like a TI or an Intel chip.
Understood. And yeah, that's something you were very familiar with. So you owned a retail franchise.
Right.
That's a very different experience. What are some of the best lessons that you learned,
right,
out of owning your own business?
Right. I think there's two lessons that I learned. You know, first of all, because I acquired it and I didn't build it from scratch, you know, I saw the business sale process from the perspective of the buyer originally. And so I knew when I took it over that I would need to pay attention of every detail, how it flows through the income statement and future valuation, so that in the future when I was ready to sell it, that, you know, I had all the control knobs built in. So, you know, every decision that I made, I needed to pay attention to that. And that's probably lesson number one, is to, you know, from day one, make sure that you're thinking about the long-term exit, maybe if it's not even for 5 or 10 years. Number two is, you know, another lesson I learned is, you know, swing for the fences, you know, pick something that's big enough that you can, you know, make a nice living or, you know, even get wealthy by hitting a home run. And it's kind of hard to do it part-time on the side.
Yeah, definitely. You got to devote your whole time if you're going to make it a success.
Right.
Tell me about McLane Group. I know a lot about the firm. I've worked,
right,
closely with them. I actually do some work for you guys, and I know a lot of your partners. Tell me what you're doing today.
Sure.
What types of projects you're getting involved with there.
Sure, yeah. So today I'm an investment banker with the McLane Group. We're based in Tyson's Corner. It's been around since about 1997, done hundreds of deals. You know, the key value proposition to my role in the firm is that I have a lot of experience both on the technology side of things as also as a small business owner. And there's a lot of folks at the McLane Group that didn't come through a traditional finance path, kind of like myself. And so we offer a lot of real-world business experience that sometimes you don't get when you just follow the standard finance path. We're a middle-market M&A firm primarily, meaning that, you know, we focus on mergers and acquisitions when shareholders are looking for some sort of an exit, and we act as the intermediary.
So middle-market is what size?
Yeah, good question. Almost everybody has a different definition of what that means, and a good rule of thumb would be is if you're looking at a company that's worth $500 million or more, that's typically going to be served by Wall Street. If you're looking at a business that's a retail mom and pop, like my GNC franchise, that's probably going to be served by a business broker. And then we do stuff that's in between. You know, maybe it's worth $10 to $100 million is a good rule of thumb.
Okay. And so you're focusing on technology,
that's right,
merger and acquisition. What are the segments that are most active in M&A right now in the technology market?
Well, overall, we see a lot of action in cybersecurity. We see a lot of action in data visualization and analysis and cloud computing.
Okay. Are you seeing an uptick in activity right now because of the fear that tax rates are going to go up next year?
We are. I mean, 2012 has been a little bit of a soft year for M&A in general, and you can read just about any report that'll tell you that. But we are seeing an uptick of deals trying to get under the finish line at the end of 2012 because, you know, capital gains taxes are expected to go up by a fair amount in addition to potentially other taxes. And so a lot of deals are getting done now that kind of, you know, it'll swing the average a little higher for the end of the year.
Okay, good. Now, technology companies I've worked with for 30 years over my career, and how do they differ from the typical government contractor? I mean, there are technology companies that are government contractors. There are those that aren't. How do they differ? What distinguishes them?
Yeah, the main difference is how they're valued. So when you take a contractor to market, I mean, they're primarily going to be valued based upon a multiple of earnings or EBITDA, right? And they're going to receive a premium for things like large prime contracts, cleared, you know, security clearances, highly cleared work. If they have some sort of, you know, differentiated IP along with the with their services work, but it boils down to a multiple of earnings, and then that control knob gets turned up or down based upon, you know, how unique is that work that they're doing.
Okay. What about technology companies?
And technology product companies are typically, again, valued differently because they're much more scalable. You can.
So how do you value a company that has a product that may or may not be patentable, but it's got something that's really cool?
Well, ultimately, it's worth whatever the buyer will pay for it.
There you go.
But
well, that was easy. Because I know you guys do valuation work, and I was just thinking to myself, how do you value that? It's got to be based on some kind of cash flow stream that's being generated from the product, right?
I mean, that's the fundamental way to value any business is the cash flow, the EBITDA earnings stream.
Right.
But when you're talking about a strategic buyer buying IP, then it's typically based off of a multiple of revenue. And then there's strategic considerations about, you know, frankly, what can they do with the technology and how can they scale it into maybe it's millions of units a year to enable them to sell more phones or more switches or whatever the case may be.
Well, when we're talking about valuation, how does McLean Group go about advising a potential client, say, about what their business might be worth in a potential deal or an acquisition coming down the pike?
Right. I mean, there's a couple of ways that we do that. I mean, first of all, we subscribe to a lot of expensive databases that cost us hundreds of thousands of dollars a year.
Is that right?
It's not cheap to get into. And so what we do with that information is we update clients by providing newsletters and database white papers, those types of things that clients can opt in or opt out of. And you also mentioned that we have a business valuation practice, which is quite large for the area. And one of the things we can do is sort of anonymously aggregate that data and give clients guidance without, you know, sharing anything that's confidential.
Right.
Because we know what deals are getting done at if we're just acting even as the business valuation advisor and not even the M&A advisor. We still know what deals are getting done at.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah.
So the valuation arm, does the valuation arm work closely with the investment banking arm?
They do. A lot of times we borrow their resources. If we're doing what we call a preliminary business valuation for a client, which is something that we don't charge for, we might leverage their resources and their expertise to make sure that we're doing it the right way and that we're on track.
What are you seeing the multiples for government contractors in the M&A area be? I mean, what are the multiples today?
Well, we always like to say that the rule of five is you start at 5x EBITDA until proven otherwise. And so proven otherwise could be if you have some of these highly valuable contracts and cleared people, for example, in the federal space, you know, maybe that creeps up to 6, 7, 8, 9, 10x EBITDA. And on the lower end, if it's just more of a, if it's something less differentiated, it might only be 1 to 2x EBITDA.
Really?
Yeah.
Somebody would actually sell for 1 to 2x EBITDA?
Well, that's a good question. Sometimes they don't.
Are the sellers finding that the buyers are there? Are there buyers out there right
they
now?
They are, but they're just much more cautious with, you know, we've had this election uncertainty, and so it's really put a lot of cash on the sidelines, and it's made them a little bit slower to act, but
do you think the cash is going to be released between now and the end of the year?
No, probably not, except for deals that are already in motion. I mean, if they're not in due diligence at this point, then it's just too late in the year. But we do expect to see a slight uptick next year because the election uncertainty is behind us.
So if you want to talk to an investment banker at McLean Group, you want to talk to Brent Lorenz, how do you get in touch with you?
Sure, Brent? Thanks. Yeah, I'm pretty easy to find. You can find me on LinkedIn, which is Brent Lorenz, L-O-R-E-N-Z. My Twitter handle is @TechMergers. And you can also email me at blorenz@mcleanllc.com.
Excellent. Thanks for being a special guest on Blueprint for Wealth.
Thanks for having me.
And you can hear Brent on the archives of Blueprint for Wealth on federalnewsradio.com or on blueprintforwealth.org. Join me next week for another special topic and special guest. I'm Wayne Zell, and sponsored by Odin Feldman and Pittleman, visit us on the web at ofplaw.com.
You've been listening to Wayne Zell and Blueprint for Wealth. Wayne will be back next Saturday morning at 10 a.m. with your Blueprint for Wealth right here on 1500 AM.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news now.
This paid commercial may not represent the view.